The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine this Tuesday, the 18th of April, 2023. How are you getting on? I hope you're very well indeed, and hopefully you're along for the ride with us for the next 3 hours here on the 9 till noon show. The lines are open for you, of course, to get involved in the conversation, raise your own issues and all that jazz. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. You can give us a call either 07491 25000. If you're outside the Republic, it's 00353 7491 25000. Caroline and Neve taking your calls there. Your emails coming to us on comments at highlandradio.com. And hop on our socials if you want to watch the show. YouTube, Facebook, and on our website directly. You can click watch live there and engage with us. Plenty coming up on the show. We have Community Garda information where you hear the latest appeals and information from An Garda Síochána first. We're going to be talking about the Ombudsman's recommendations to the HSE as it relates to, and I'll read about that in the papers in a moment, as it relates to people getting treatment abroad. We've highlighted this for years on this programme, thanks to you raising it with us. And hopefully that's had some influence in this Ombudsman's report. I'm sure it has. And hopefully things will improve for those of you out there who have availed of the service in the past or intend to do so in the future. There's that and much, much more. Stay with us, of course. Let's have a look at the front of the papers and on some occasions inside the papers. We're going to start with the Donegal Democrat this morning. Rotten Island Lighthouse at the entrance to Killybegs Harbour has the potential to be one of the most iconic attractions in the county, but it is badly in need of a fresh coat of paint. That's according to Cathaoirleach of the Municipal District of Donegal, Councillor Neve Kennedy. She raised the matter through a motion at the April meeting of the MD, calling for a request to be made to Irish Lights to please paint the external walls of the Rotten Island Lighthouse. The Derry Journal this morning at the other end of the county. It is incumbent that negotiations on 58 social houses in Carn Donagh are processed as soon as possible, a local county councillor has said. Councillor Albert Doherty was speaking after it was once again confirmed Donegal County Council is continuing to liaise with the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage and the developer in relation to the 58 houses at Convent Road. Councillor Doherty pointed out that the answer he received at the recent initial municipal district meeting relating to the negotiations was the same as the one he received 5 months ago. He said, if we are sitting with 58 finished houses and finished from a period, maybe at least prior to Christmas, whatever about earlier than that, it's incumbent on whoever and wherever the talks are that extra piece of movement is put on them. At this stage, there is a void to be filled and people are asking why this hasn't progressed. But I saw some statistics yesterday published. I don't have them to hand, but I will dig them out. I think Donegal County Council only bought or provided three social housing houses last year. As I say, I don't want to misquote the situation, but what I'll do is I'll dig those figures out and go back at them. There is a serious issue here. There are houses knocking about the place, or houses that could be acquired. Okay, here it is. Affordable housing output from Donegal County Council. The council's generally just 323 affordable purchased homes last year, just 684 cost rental homes, 750 high-risk shared equity loans over the period of last year. That's nationally. So what's happened in Donegal in terms of local authority affordable purchase scheme delivered? Donegal County Council, zero. In terms of cost rental, 684 across the country. In Donegal, zero. Completely. First homes, three. That's it. First homes, that's the total for Donegal, three. Now, that's not everything. That's one set of figures, but there's a serious problem there, isn't there? Right, OK, on to the Nationals now. They are extensively covered in the Hutch story, of course. Gerry Hutch, he was acquitted yesterday of the 2016 Regency Hotel murder of David Byrne. Come as a shock to some, not to others. We're going to be speaking about this in the not-too-distant future. He's been told, though, that he remains under investigation by the Gardaí over allegations he directed an organised crime gang. Why was that not included in the charges he was facing last time out. The inquiry is also examining whether Hutch 60 was tipped off from inside the Gardaí about a European arrest warrant issued for him in 2021. Detectives from the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation have already arrested and interviewed Hutch while he was in custody, awaiting trial for Byrne's killing. Former Garda Superintendent John Murphy, who was convicted of possessing cannabis at his North Dublin home in 2021, was also questioned as part of the same investigation. Garda sources said the now expected father of five, Hutch of the Paddocks Clontarfin of North Dublin, to leave the jurisdiction. The Special Criminal Court found no evidence to support the allegation he was one of the shooters on the day, though it believed the Hutch faction was behind the attack. But as I say, there were no charges attached to that he could be found guilty of, even if it could have been proven. There will be questions asked of the DPP selecting the charges that they did. In reply to queries last night, Garda HQ said it noted the not guilty verdict against Hutch and the guilty verdicts against two other men, namely Paul Murphy, 61, of Cherry Avenue Swords, and Jason Bonney, 50, from Drumna Woods, Portarnock, on lesser charges of facilitating the attack by acting as drivers on the day. It added the investigation of the Regency attack was ongoing. So three people have been charged in relation to the murder on that day, all three. The cases have not progressed, or they were found not guilty. Okay. As I say, that's across all papers. In terms of the Nationals, if you're not interested in that story, it's slim pickings elsewhere. Right, just back to this story we mentioned. It was carried in the news from Donna Marie, and then I had a little rattle at it. Patients who availed of the HSE's treatment abroad schemes were driven into debt and suffered mental distress after they were refused reimbursements, a highly critical ombudsman report reveals today. And we've heard lots of these stories on this show. The ombudsman, Ger Deering, who will join us after 11, by the way, investigated the various schemes operated by the HSE, including the cross-border directive, where an approved patient pays up front for their treatment abroad with the expectation they will be refunded by the HSE. However, he found inflexibility and confusion were often older people on the state pension were left to pay back borrowings after the HSE money failed to come through. And you know the stories too. People were approved, went through the process, and then it was argued with them that only half the money or a third of the money or none of the money would be payable to them. This at the same time, and you see it on social media, I see it all the time, where people will post up a random comment like, does anyone have a receipt for a purchase in such and such a place on such and such a date on a certain year? It's not explained as to what it's for, but I imagine it's part of all this silly process that someone has to go into a shop and buy something in order to have a successful claim from the HSE. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. I'll be putting that to the ombudsman, that type of strange behaviour to the ombudsman a little later on. So he found inflexibility and confusion, as I mentioned. I saw people had borrowed significant amounts of money from family, friends and financial institutions to pay for their treatment with the expectation they'd be able to pay them back when reimbursed by the state. When a refund was subsequently refused, these patients effectively exchanged the anxiety and worry associated with their illness for a new stress of dealing with a debt incurred while assessing a treatment they were entitled to receive but could not access within the state. Let's not forget that. That's the only reason people will avail of this scheme, is that they should be able to get it here, but they can't. So we pay private hospitals to do it elsewhere. And then when you go to try and get reimbursed, they play silly buggers with you then. OK, so we'll have more on that later on in the programme, so stay tuned for that. And if you that regularly listen to the show for quite some time have been very interested in, and I must say to some extent concerned about artificial intelligence, the speed in which it is developing and being adopted is crazy. It really is crazy. We don't know where we're going with this. We could literally be talking some Terminator-style stuff. Google's boss, this is in the Irish Daily Mail, Google's boss has admitted he doesn't fully understand how the company's new AI program Bard works, as a new expose shows some of the kinks are still being worked out. One of the problems discovered with Bard is something that Sundar Pichai called emergent properties, or AI systems having taught themselves unforeseen skills. Google's AI program was able to learn Bangladeshi without training after being prompted in the language. Okay, so if you haven't gone on ChatGPT, you should. It's really quite impressive. It's really quite worrying. And this is only just the tip of the iceberg. So they've created this artificial intelligence. They didn't program it to learn Bangladeshi, but someone asked a question in that language and it had completely trained itself in its language without having been told to. All of us in the field call it a black box. You know, you don't fully understand, Mr. Pichet said. And you can't quite tell why it said this or why it got wrong or why it got wrong. Well, words missing there. We have some ideas and our ability to understand this gets better over time. Let me put it this way. I don't think we fully understand how a human mind works either. So that's it now. I saw an email come in to the Highland Radio News account yesterday from a company looking to spread artificial intelligence that writes press releases for presumably government parties or individuals or whatever it might be. That's where we're at already. Okay, this is a horrendous story from the Irish Daily Star. It's in many papers on the news as well. Two police officers in Northern Ireland are set to be prosecuted following the leaking of images from the scenes of sudden deaths. The two officers are to be prosecuted for alleged misconduct in public office. The region's public prosecution service made the announcement after considering the evidence submitted in an investigation filed by the Police Ombudsman for Northern Ireland. The Operation Warwick investigation examined a number of instances, including the alleged sharing of imagery taken at the scene of sudden deaths. There's already been a decision to prosecute one individual for three counts of improper use of a public electronic communications network, contrary to an Act of 203. Following the submissions of a separate file by the PSNI, the individual is being prosecuted in connection with the alleged sharing of imagery captured at the scenes of sudden deaths. That case is currently in hearing. And the more you dig into that story, the more concerning it gets in that the deceased were posed for some pictures. So, you know, and you can imagine the horrendous experience of families being compounded by that type of activity. The Irish Sun this morning, more than a million Irish people, many of you listening, will get a €200 boost next week. The latest cost of living bonus payment will be handed to the recipients of over 30 regular payments from next Monday. The 261 million boost was confirmed in the government's spring bonuses in February. Pensioners, carers, people with disabilities, lone parents, widows and widowers will all get the extra €200 on the same day they get their normal weekly payment. The government confirmed the €200 lump sum will be paid in the week commencing April 24th to people in receipt of long-term social welfare payments. Over 600,000 pensioners are set to benefit, while 60,000 on job seekers, 158,000 receiving disability allowance and 50,000 carers will also be given that €200. So hopefully that comes now as a welcome, an important boost to some of you out there. And Simeon Burke had his day in court yesterday. Obviously not much coverage of it because of another court appearance. Law student Simeon Burke has been convicted of an offence under the Public Order Act, fined €300 following his arrest during a disturbance at the Court of Appeal last month. Mr. Burke, 24, from Castlebar, County Mayo, had denied the charge and said there were no disturbances in the court on March 7th before he and other family members were forcibly removed by Gardaí. He also claimed he had never been asked to leave the court. But Judge John Hughes said he did not accept Mr. Burke's evidence or the allegations he made against Gardaí and said the prosecution had proven its case. Mr. Burke said he did not accept the conviction and would not be paying the fine. He left the court with his family. But I note on social media many, many people offering to pay that fine on his behalf. All right, that's a run through is what's making the headlines today. Anything you wish to comment on or, as I say, raise your own comments or issues or pass on some news to us. Good news. Did something nice happen to you? Has someone done something good for you? Have you had a recent achievement? We're happy to hear all manner of things. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts. Right. I'm very pleased to welcome onto the programme now crime journalist with the Irish Independent and author of The Monk, The Life and Crimes of Ireland's Most Enigmatic Gang Boss. He is Paul Williams, of course. Paul, thank you very much for your time this morning. I'm sure you're in great demand. We do appreciate your joining us.
You're very welcome, Greg. No problem at all.
Right. Briefly, I suppose, why was Jerry Hodge in court yesterday, and who was in court alongside him?
Well, yesterday was, you know, we called it the gangland trial of the century. There was only, it was one trial that I've, you know, that apart from maybe one or two other trials in the past 10 or 20 years, really did draw a huge amount of attention from the public. It started last October. It lasted for 52 days. It was the trial of Jerry Hutch for the murder of David Byrne at the infamous Regency Hotel attack in 2016. And two of his mates, who are also co-accused, they were charged with participating or facilitating the murder gang who were involved in that by acting as getaway drivers on the day. Now, they were convicted. Jerry Hutch was acquitted yesterday. And it was a very, very momentous day and a very, very important day, because this was one of the most high-profile criminal outrages that we have ever seen in this country. Mm. Jerry Hutch is a very famous, almost celebrity status criminal. He has always been a fascinating character. I know I'm saying that because I've written a book about him, but people have always found him a fascinating character, because he stands out from the crowd. He's not like the other breed of criminals we have. But there were so many other elements to this case. You know, you had the dramatic development where former Sinn Féin councillor Jonathan Dowdall, who was a friend of the family and had been asked by Patsy Hutch, Jerry Hutch's brother, to intervene in this simmering feud in around 2015 into 2016. Jerry Hutch's nephew, had been murdered by Daniel Kenahan's hitmen. He originally, a year earlier, tried to kill Daniel Kenahan. They were all involved in the drug trade together, and like all these other thugs, they all fall out. And a deal had been done in between, whereby the person who was sent to shoot Daniel Kenahan had to present himself in Dublin to be shot in the legs. His name is Patrick Hutch Jr. And then the deal was done, the money was paid over, and they all agreed, because he was so-called gangland royalty, that he wouldn't be touched. But they reneged on that deal, and they murdered Gary Hutch in September of 2015. And that's where all of this started. On the same day, the mob, the hitmen for the cartel, tried to shoot Patsy Hutch on the same day, about an hour later, when he was at collecting his grandchildren from school. That didn't work, because Hutch had been told just before that his son had been murdered, so he was obviously distracted. And then they tried to murder Jerry Hutch himself in a bar in Lanzarote on New Year's Eve in 2015. So that set the stage for what became known as the Regency Hotel attack. And the plan of the Regency Hotel attack was to wipe out the entire leadership of, like, a St. Valentine's Day massacre, like to wipe out the entire leadership of the cartel. Daniel Kenahan, Liam Byrne, all the major players in the gang were there for this boxing weigh-in. The guys went in very, very heavily armed. I think that's the thing that has made this case so fascinating. It was the level of strength and the level of violence that was used. Three men dressed as members of an ERU SWAT team stormed a building armed with AK-47s, while another couple, two other hitmen, one dressed as a woman and one a guy called Flat Cap, who's known as Kevin Murray, a former dissident Republican from Strabane. They were the second tactical team that were sent in that day. And there was 250 people in the hotel. We all know the rest of the story. It was absolutely terrifying. They tried to create a trap where they would drive their victims towards the lobby, where these men dressed with the AK-47s were waiting, and they would just riddle them. Now, the only person they got in the end was David Byrne. The good part about it was, or the most positive part about it was, that they didn't kill or shoot any innocent civilians, apart from terrorizing the living daylights out of them. And that was what brought us then to Jerry Hutch. The investigation started after that in earnest. They started targeting Jonathan Dowdall, the Gardaí, at an early stage. Dowdall was a close friend of the family. As I said, he'd been asked to intervene at this stage by Patsy Hutch to talk to, through Pierce McCauley, which was referred to on several occasions by the court. Like, Pierce McCauley, who was described as a violent, vicious thug, a dangerous and violent terrorist. He got 12 years, you may recall, for attacking his wife, in the most savage attack on his wife, one Christmas Eve about 10 years ago. So he went to McCauley. McCauley set up meetings in Strabane and Donegal and Derry with dissident Republicans. One of them was a guy called Shane Roan, who was subsequently convicted in relation to this. So one of the, when the Gardaí discovered, how the Gardaí discovered Jonathan Dowdall's involvement was that his father had booked a room in the hotel the night before the attack took place. And that room was used by Kevin Flatcap Murray, one of the hitmen, the guy who was who has always been described as Flatcap and is now has died from motor neuron disease since. Now, it was very easy for them to trace back who booked that room, so they put surveillance on the Dowdalls. They bugged a Jeep belonging to Dowdall after spotting him in the company of Jerry Hutch. There was this famous 10 hours of tapes that were played last December in the court where the two guys travelled to Northern Ireland to meet dissident Republicans at two meetings, one in Strabane, another one over near Belfast. And the state's case initially was that there's enough evidence on these tapes to charge both Dowdall and Jerry Hutch with murder. And then coming up to the trial date last year, Dowdall started having secret negotiations with the police and said he was prepared to go come forward as a state witness. His evidence was, or his allegation was, two parts to his allegations. One, that he, on the night before the Regency Hotel attack, he met Jerry Hutch and handed Jerry Hutch over the key cards to this famous room that Flatcap Murray was booked to stay in. He then claimed that 2 days after the attack at the Regency, he met with Jonathan Dowdall in a park in Whitehall in North Dublin, and he basically was in a very rattled and panicked state, and he confessed to Jonathan Dowdall that he was one of the shooters, one of the attack team dressed up with the AK-47s and as ERU men who shot dead David Byrne, and he was upset about it and he wanted to make peace. Now, so that was the gist of the state's case. He turned just literally a week before it became, it was revealed about a week before the trial, or less than a week before the trial started, that he was going to give evidence. Then he became the centrepiece of the trial. Mm. He was in the box for something like 8 days in one of the most robust cross-examinations I've ever.
Okay, we seem to have lost that line to Paul Williams there, unfortunately. We'll see if we can get Paul back, will we? Unfortunately, that's just we were just getting to the crux of the case, so to speak. So stay with us. We'll try and get Paul Williams back on. 086 60 25000, that's our WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 07491 25000. Right, as I say, just whilst we wait for Paul to recollect, just a couple of comments coming in here. A lot of cars hanging around Knockalla Hill Climb Road yesterday, diffing and messing about. They were safe and only diffed when the road was clear, but it was quite alarming. They were safe, they say. It was quite alarming, but it was quite alarming to see on a public road, is the conclusion of that. It's not really, shouldn't be allowed, and it isn't allowed. But Greg, I've been trying to get an appointment with my local Intrio office. You have to phone a nationwide phone number dealing with the entire country. I have wasted 30 euro trying to phone, but the credit runs out. I can't afford to be wasting money this way. It's ridiculous. I can't phone the local office directly. Any help with that would be greatly appreciated. Paul, sorry, we lost the line there and we were just getting to...
Sorry, Greg, I don't know what's happening. The connection between Donegal and Dublin seems to have fallen down. I don't know where I was. I was blathering away there.
No, that's okay. You were just getting to the point where we had got to the trial, right? You were talking about Dowdall's evidence and how he became available to the prosecution very shortly before the start of the trial. But if that hadn't come to pass, what evidence did the state actually have then against Mr. Hutch?
Well, there are a lot of questions being asked about that, because you have to remember that up until, say, September of last year, just before the trial started, when a deal was done with the DPP and Jonathan Dowdall's solicitors, that the case was relying on a charge of murder against him and against Jerry Hutch based on the 10 hours of tapes when they travelled to Northern Ireland. Now, so... I was there for those tapes being played, and you know, myself and my colleagues compiled as rough a transcript as we could get on it. And one of the points the court made yesterday was that there was no evidence. There was nowhere did Jared Hutch admit in any way, or anything that he said could be construed in any way as an admission that he was involved in the Regency Hotel attack. But it was very, very clear from the recordings was that he talks repeatedly about the three yokes. The three yokes are the three AK-47s used in the attack. And he's talking quite openly to Jonathan Dowdall about throwing these up to them, as in he was giving these as a present to the dissident IRA the continuity of the real IRA. I don't know which one. There was always confusion about which one. And your man Shane Roan, this guy who lived in Donegal, dissident Republican, he came down and he collected the guns. Now, this famous taping recording took place on 7th of March 2016, a month after the Regency Hotel attack. 2 days after this trip took place, the guns were to be moved. Shane Roan came down to collect them. He met Patsy Hutch. Other men arrived, put the weapons into the boot of his car. He was driving back to the north when he was intercepted by the ERU and arrested. And those guns were subsequently ballistically and forensically tested and proved to have been the murder weapons. So there was very much a clear case here, Greg, of that Jerry Hutch could be charged with possession of firearms and also with directing a criminal gang, both of which are identifiable offences under anti-gangland legislation. For some reason, the state did not charge Jared Hutch with either of those offences.
And would the DPP, would the DPP give an explanation for that, Paul?
No, the DPP doesn't give explanations for any of this kind of stuff. And, you know, there is an awful lot of public sympathy for Jerry Hutch. And Jerry Hutch is a criminal, as I said to you at the beginning, stands apart. Now, I've written about him very, very extensively through the years, and I do know quite a lot about him. And he is the nearest thing to an ordinary, decent criminal that you will get, because he adheres to some kind of code of ethics. He's a good family man. He is also a guy who eschewed the drug trade, that he's not a glad-handling, swaggering criminal going around bullying people and terrorizing people. However, he has still been involved in a life of serious organized crime. It was a very serious offense he was involved in, moving those guns, having possession of those guns. And nobody can understand why the state didn't pursue those other charges. And the judges themselves basically said that yesterday. He said, you know, he is not here. There is evidence of these things, but he is not here to answer that charge. He can only be assessed on the charge of murder. And what happened was the prosecution then, as Brendan Graham, the defence counsel, said, tried to ride two horses, and they fell between both. And that was, they were using the tape recordings, as main base evidence, but then they were relying on Jonathan Dalzell. So they changed the prosecution narrative from being one that he was involved generally in the murder of David Byrne to being very specific, say, based on this alleged admission Hutch made to Dowdle that he was there, that he was one of the guys with the AK-47. So suddenly they said he was one of the two guys who murdered David Byrne. And that was a huge mountain to climb in terms of proving that beyond all reasonable doubt. And they never even at any stage came close to that. And the court clearly found that yesterday.
I imagine there'll be some frustration within Ongata Shiokana as well. There were also other witnesses that might have been able to corroborate some of what Dowdall was saying that weren't called. For what reason do we know?
Sorry, I missed that. There was a slight blip on the line. Sorry.
No problem. I was saying there was also some witnesses, whether or not, that could have perhaps corroborated what Dowdall was saying, but they weren't called.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, like Patrick Dowdall was one of the mysteries there, because Patrick Dowdall is the father of Jonathan Dowdall. He was the man who went and booked the room, because Patsy Hutch asked him to book this room. He said it was for a friend of his, and Patrick Dowdall was with his son when they handed over the key cards to Jerry Hutch. So it was amazing, even though he's in prison now and he's pleaded guilty as well, and he will be in the witness protection program, there was never any explanation given as to why he didn't testify. And he could have corroborated his son's testimony. Now, that whole thing is like, in terms of how you deal with, accomplice evidence, you cannot accept the accomplice evidence. And this bar, this standard was set way back when we had the first so-called supergrass trials in this country, and that was on the back of the murder of Veronica Gearn when John Gilligan's gang turned against him. And the strict rule the court has always adhered to was you cannot accept the uncorroborated words of an accomplice witness because they are criminals themselves. As I remember a guard would famously say to me many years ago, you know, these people are not nice people. Why would they be? You don't go to the local parish priest asking him to testify in a case against a gangland figure. You have to go to somebody who's in the middle of it all. Dowdall, for his part, presented as the most appalling individual. He was a whingy, moaning, awful. He was laden with self-pity. He just he just really, I suppose the term is, pissed everybody off. People who were even just watching the trial, because he was just whining on and moaning and being very defensive. And you could, and he was caught telling lies. Go back to Piers McCauley I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Like, Piers McCauley is an appalling individual in the eyes of the court as well. And he said at one stage, Brendan Graham had really done his work, the defence, and he said, you know, you are going to see Piers McCauley. Yeah, how many times did you go to see him? 3 times. And your man said to him, Graham said, no, you didn't. And he said, no, I only went to see him 3 times. And he was able to produce evidence. The defence was able to prove evidence, produce evidence that he had visited McCauley 14 times in prison. Mm. So the judges really highlighted that yesterday and said that to them proved that he was a barefaced liar, and they couldn't trust a word out of his mouth.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, Jared Hutch today is a free man because Jonathan Dowdall decided to become a state witness and throw his lot in. I think that it may have been a different result if the two of them had been on trial together for murder, because you would have had to listen to the 10 hours of dialogue on the tapes with different ears.
Yeah.
Because now you have the two of them sitting in the dock as defendants in this murder case, and there would be no doubt that the two of them were involved in planning something very, very serious.
Okay, two more short...
That's in the lap of the gods.
Exactly, two more short questions, Paul. I really appreciate your time. But what about then the entire handling of this case? A huge profile case. The ramifications go far beyond it in terms of its impact on boxing and the business itself and all the individuals there. I mean, the ripples on this are absolutely huge. But this is the third attempt to find someone responsible for this murder that has failed.
It is, yeah. But the first major case was the trial of Jerry Hutch, who is Jerry Hutch's nephew, and he was accused of being the guy dressed up as a woman. Now, that fell because Colin Fox, who was a very fine police officer, ended up taking his own life. And as a result of that, in 2018, then in 2019, the case fell because there were issues, that there were doubts created because he left a note and stuff, and he was the senior investigating officer. So what did he know? Why did he take his own life? All of those questions. And in the midst of all of that, there were issues around the identification of Patrick Hutch. So that case was nolly prosequi. A nolly prosequi was entered in that, but basically dropped the charges. Then there was, like, the Dowdall was charged along with his father, and then the other two men who are, by the way, convicted yesterday, and everyone's forgotten about them, Jason Bonney and Paul Murphy, two old friends of Hutch's, they were charged and convicted of facilitating the gang, as in they provided getaway cars for two of the killers, including Fat Cap, on the day of the murder. They have been convicted. And technically, of course, Dowdall and his father have been convicted last September because they pleaded guilty to the same charge of facilitating. So four people are in prison. Two of the main players have been acquitted. And the Gardaí are saying they're still investigating this. But you have to remember, when you take on a major criminal organisation run by very clever individuals, it's a very, very murky world anyway to start with, Greg. But to try and break through that and, you know, to ascertain and establish our people telling the truth, it's a big job because, you know, people would say, well, why did they put Dowdall on the stand in the first place? Well, the reason they put Dowdall on the stand in the first place was because he gave them an extensive statement alleging what he knew. They knew he was a major player. They had the tapes of Dowdall, and they felt he was a strong witness. Because the guards can't sit down and the DPP can't sit down and question him at length to test and see how he would perform in court. Yeah. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. They must just leave it in the lap of the gods and let him go in, testify, give his evidence, and let the court test the veracity and honesty of that evidence. And that's exactly what happened here. And as a result of that, Jerry Hutch is contemplating, he's 60 now, he's probably enjoying his 60th birthday, which fell last week while he was still in prison. And I'd say he would get out of town as quickly as he can, and he will not be seen here again for a long time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What next for him? That was my final question, but you've answered that. And where is he likely to go?
Oh, but he's a lot of property. He's a very wealthy man. Okay. He started investing money from his robberies when he was 16 years of age, 17 years of age. That's one of the things that makes him stand out from the crowd as well. So he's a very extensive property portfolio in UK, Ireland. A lot of vast majority of it, not in his name, of course. He has property right across Europe. He certainly has played. He's a villa in Lanzarote, where he was living and enjoying his retirement, and no doubt he will go back there. There's one part about it, though. There is one other issue in it all, and that is that he can never absolutely be sure that he is safe. He will always have to look over his shoulder, because even though the Kinahans are being squeezed internationally from all sides, even though the Kinahan cartel has been completely eviscerated in the Republic of Ireland, where their major base was, like over 70 members of their organisation are behind bars, and that includes some of the main, the core of killers who used to be used by gangland. And one of the things, of course, we found out about the Kinahans is that they were responsible for most of the murders that were taking place in this town for years. Now, they don't have the capacity to shoot Jerry Hutch dead on the street in Buckingham Street today. No matter even if they had €1 million, they wouldn't find anyone to do it, because the people just aren't there. And also, they have been so heavily infiltrated by the police and security services across the world that they couldn't organise a piss-up in a brewery right now. So the only place that Jerry Hutch will have to worry about is when he's abroad. And there will always be the chance that some guy will take a contract from somebody. Mm. Like the Byrne gang are still quite strong. They have money. They may find somebody who could decide, you know, to try and make their names in gang. Now, some idiot will produce a gun and shoot him. So, you know, use the old Provo line, you know, Jerry Hutch now has to be lucky all the time. The Kinahans only have to be lucky once.
Yeah, and what a way to live your life. I don't think it could be underestimated. Finally, just
no,
in terms
of the faint-hearted.
Exactly. Just in terms of your book, Paul, do you update it now? Do you add to it? Or is that a piece of work that just sits there?
Oh, no, I've the process of updating it, yeah. Because, like, this, you know, in the last edition of the book I did in 2020, I said, you know, the last chapter has not yet been written in the life of Jared Hutch. And it certainly hasn't. And this is the last chapter. And, in fact, it's not one chapter, it's maybe six or seven chapters have gone into the book. We've done an extensive rewrite, so hopefully that'll be coming out in the next month or so.
Excellent, okay.
And that'll be fully updated to today, basically.
It's literally, we're living in the history and it'll be written. Okay, listen, Paul, thank you very much for so much of your time. I really appreciate
it.
Take care of yourself. Paul Williams there, crime journalist with Irish Independent, of course, and author of that book, The Monk, The Life and Crimes of Ireland's Most Enigmatic Gang Boss. And as you heard from him yourself there, he's in the process currently of writing the next chapters. Right, now we welcome onto the show Paula Kenny, National Manager for Social Housing with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Good morning to you, Paula.
Morning, Craig.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you on the programme. So talk to me about St. Vincent de Paul's role in housing.
Yeah, just to say that a lot of people are not aware that along with the core work of the Society, that we're also an approved housing body, and we provide homes to over 920 people nationally. And over 210 of those homes are provided in the Northwest region across Donegal, Leitrim and Sligo. And those homes have been delivered and are managed by a network of volunteer groups. And we provide homes across 17 locations in the Northwest region. So we typically accommodate older people, and that category of need lends itself very well to the volunteer-led management. And all our tenants must qualify to be on the local authority housing list. So I'm on this morning as the Society wants to strengthen our volunteer base. We always, I suppose, on an ongoing basis, we look to recruit new volunteers, make sure we have sufficient numbers across our areas. I suppose things change on, you know, with volunteer groups. You know, people have been involved for a very long time, want to change, people fall ill. So we want to replenish, and we also want to rejuvenate. We're currently operating housing in a very highly regulated environment. So we want to bring on skill sets now that complement the work of our social housing provision. So in terms of skill set, I suppose that's what we're here to talk about. We can look at it across two areas, across the property and also across the people. And on the property side, there's work around looking at, you know, the repairs and maintenance side of property. As an approved housing body, we continuously look at improving our standards.
And is that to assess the properties for that work or to carry that work out, Paula?
It's to, every, I suppose, group looks at that in different ways. A lot would have different people, you know, contractors involved. So it's about looking at ways to, you know, for efficiency of management across the asset. And also we continuously look at improving our stock. Mm. So, you know, people are involved in refurbishments, energy upgrades, maybe adaptations, and safety management is also a big part of the property side. So we're looking at people, take on people with skill sets from maybe engineering, surveying, property management, safety management. They're fantastic skills to bring on board. And then when you look at the people side of it...
Well, before we get to the people side of it, just in terms of that, those roles that you talk of, it's not a massive a commitment that you're seeking, but it's not an insignificant commitment either. So what kind of time would people need to have available? And I suppose, how available do they need to be to give that time?
Well, we typically say, as a marker, about 3 hours per week would be the requirement for a volunteer. And then based on the area of work that they're involved in, that could change from week to week. But I suppose the more people you have involved in a group, you know, you can have greater delegation of tasks.
Right. So you might have multiple people working responsible for the same group of housing or house, for example. They work together as a team. Okay. So that workload is shared then, of course.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we see across the country the fantastic variation of skills that are involved in different groups. It really works very well.
And then we're going to talk about the people. Yes, go ahead, Paula.
Yes, the work on that side of things is varied. It can range from, you know, rental income management to tenancy selection. We often need to signpost our tenants to different supports within the community. And also a lot of the tenants that we accommodate come to us that mightn't have family or friends around them. So we like to create a sense of community, and we often host different events and run different activities for our tenants. And that can, you know, can be anything from coffee mornings to book clubs or gardening classes or whatever. So there's lots that people can get involved in. And so, you know, if you're a people person, if you have maybe a background in social care, social work, nursing, you know, they're all very valuable and beneficial skills to have on board.
And the people
and also just to say, Craig, as well, that every group benefits from somebody with a financial background, an administration background, for all that, you know, for the reporting side of things as well. So there's it's a great, you know, there's lots of different things you can get involved in.
So talk to me about what the volunteers say to you that they get from it themselves.
It's interesting you asked that, because I was just talking to someone last week, and they said to me that they get way more out of it than they put in. You know, the ability to provide a home to somebody is just the impact that has on that person. It's life changing, and we want to be able to continue our work because it is so important, particularly in the current housing crisis. It's very rewarding for the people that are involved. And also, a lot of people that come to us want to volunteer or maybe freshly retired, and they want to give something back, and they want to utilise their skills that they've built up over their working lives. And it's, you know, it's a great enjoyment and, as I said, rewarding to those
people. You know, because we do hear of, and quite rightly so, and we'll continue to platform it, the plight of people and the difficulties that are out there. But it's also, it's comforting, I find it comforting to think of these people, and you talk about them, some of them being older, to have a roof over their head, but to also have that support, and also those particularly without families, you know, maybe people that never had children and they're widowed or a widower or something like that there. And it's comforting to know that there are groups out there like St. Vincent de Paul that are there for them so they can be happy and enjoy the rest of their lives. You know, a lot of that goes on, but obviously we're going to focus on, you know, having that situation for everyone. But I think it's important too, as we are doing right now, to recognise that a lot of people are living in contentment because of the likes of the work of St. Vincent de Paul.
And we say, you know, there's a great added value that comes with the volunteer involvement. And we're more than the bricks and mortar. We try to build communities and engage with our tenants to provide them with support. So it's more than what others, the larger bodies or you know, others would provide.
All right. So if you have a background at architecture, engineering, surveying, health and safety, social work, social care, you'd be a great fit for any of these positions. You can make an initial inquiry by emailing lisa.hitchen, H-I-T-C-H-E-N, at svp.ie. We'll retain that here, just in case you didn't happen to have a pen with you, and we can pass it on. And also, there's an event, is there, taking place in Buncrana tomorrow night. What's that about, Paula?
Yeah, that's correct. That's around recruitment of volunteers for our operations in Buncrana. We provide 29 homes in Buncrana across four different locations. So we'd love to strengthen our volunteer base there. So encourage people to come along and talk to our regional social housing officer, Lisa, where she'll give you some more information on our operations and also an opportunity for people to ask questions and get some more detail on what's involved.
Yeah, and yous provide support. There's layers, isn't there, here? You know, you recruit volunteers, and those volunteers are supported by other people in the work that they're doing as well. You're not necessarily left to your own devices to try and figure it all out yourself.
No, in every region, we provide support to our volunteers, to our regional social housing officers. And we also provide training, initial training and ongoing training for our volunteers. So there is a support network there. And you're not alone. We have over 17 groups across the Northwest region. We bring them together every once a quarter as well. So there's a link to region and also to national, to the groups national.
All right, Paula, hopefully you get a great response to it. Thanks so much for joining us and have a lovely morning. Okay, take care of yourself. That is Paula Kenny, National Manager for Social Housing with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. As I say, if you have an interest in volunteering with them in that area, you can make an inquiry by emailing lisa.hitchen at svp.ie, lisa.hitchen at svp.ie. And then there is that meeting in St. Mary's Hall, Buncrana, tomorrow evening, which starts at 7:30 p.m. Let's get to some of your comments here coming in so far this morning. The Hutch trial only reinforced two established certainties. The guards are hopeless. The only thing I'll say in relation to that is the DPP that decided what charges to bring against Gerry Hutch, not the Gardaí. So the Gardaí can investigate. They present the evidence that they have, what they can prove. And you heard from Mr. Williams there, there probably was quite a few things that could have been proven. I don't know. Everyone's innocent until proven otherwise. But it was the Director of Public Prosecutions that decided to go with the case as it was there. So I am sure there are perhaps some within the force that might not be too happy about that. A caller says, some justice system when the Hutch gang get away and the Burke family get fined. Well, it's about proving it, isn't it? And everyone saw and heard of the Burkes' interactions with the courts. Recross border. Had a family member avail of the scheme, had big operation and discharged the next day. Took two family members to take the patient to the car as they were unable to walk unaided. When we went to claim back, we were asked for a receipt for a shop or a coffee dock. When unable to produce this and explained they'd had a major operation and could hardly walk or eat, was told you should have purchased something as proof you were at the hospital. Long story short, was only refunded 25% and left the bill of around 10k. Can you put it to the ombudsman? Why is a receipt needed for a coffee to prove you're in a hospital when you're billed a huge sum of money? Ridiculous to say the least. I'm sure the person asking that question must be mortified if they're being made to do it by management. But please, if you haven't, please raise this case with the ombudsman's office, because they can direct the HSC in some instances to make redress. I will certainly put that to the ombudsman. I'm going to put that to one side. That's not unique, by the way. That happens. I know for a fact that it happens, because I do see the posts on social media where people are looking for a receipt for a shop in Derry, for example, from a year ago, because you'd be up to high dough, wouldn't you? You're not going to remember to get a receipt in a shop, or you could misplace it, or it could fade. You could leave it in the sun. You know what I mean? So definitely, I'm going to be looking for the ombudsman's opinions in that regard. Okay.